This is Maggie Jones. I'm reading again from Sumner Madison's book, A Field. And this is Eric Epstein's chapter. And he's talking about when he gave up being a blues musician in Milwaukee in the 70s and started getting real interested in birds and decided to go back to school and some of the things he was reading. My last couple of years playing music, I'd started reading more across a broad array of subjects. I read Curtis's The Vegetation of Wisconsin in the late 70s. I thought it was a really good read, but I'm apparently in the minority. But I read it and thought, how did this guy do all of this? How did he come to these conclusions, and where are these places? He mentioned the State Scientific Areas Program, and Curtis was on the very first Scientific Areas Board, along with Aldo Leopold. So reading that book made me think that I really needed to get out and see some of these places. Trips to the scientific areas and many other places, discovered in a variety of ways, and what I experienced there became my Rosetta Stone. I also read Leopold's A Sand County Almanac and some of his other essays and was struck by how you could read something this guy had written in 1933 about a trip to Germany, about forests then, and what had happened there, and how they were being managed, and especially how they had been altered by their different land use histories. It was illuminating. Some of the imagery he used to paint word pictures really spoke to me because I had observed and puzzled over similar or parallel situations in Wisconsin. I found it easy to relate what he had seen and how he had described that to what I had also seen. He made the science and natural history live, and as a bonus provided insight. Another book, Those of the Forest by Wallace Grange, was a very creative way to approach forest interrelationships through the eyes, mind, and life of an ancient rabbit with all the changes that are part of the great cycle of life. There was something comforting as well as revealing in that. It was a kind of book that if I had kids, I would have read passages to them frequently. My dogs love stories about rabbits. I often like reading correspondence between authors because it was less self-conscious than many of their more formal published efforts. Also, I was reading a lot of published scientific papers. There's no end to that stuff. Most of it, no matter how good the idea is, I don't enjoy, but it gives the background needed to say certain things or make points effectively, and it's absolutely crucial in terms of enrichment, understanding, and personal evolution. Technical writing is certainly not my forte, neither by inclination nor ability, but I've been lucky enough to work with several individuals who excel at such endeavors and owe each of them a great debt. Most of you know who you are. Finally, for anyone more interested in beetles, birds of paradise, orangutans, and biogeography than finches and tortoises, check out Alfred Russel Wallace, whose birth date was January 1823. Wallace suffered because he was poor his entire life, though he did a lot of hard traveling. He collected insects and birds in the Amazon for 4 years. The ship on which he sent all of his specimens back to England burned and sank during that voyage. All was lost, and those specimens were his livelihood. But he went out again. At least one biographer described Wallace as Darwin's satellite, Darwin's moon or competitor. That struck me as horribly off target. Darwin was establishment and a classic gentleman naturalist, albeit one with brilliance, and who knew that he was in fact a revolutionary, which must have given him many a sleepless night. Wallace was quite the opposite and became something of a spiritualist late in life. No one was more fiercely independent or persistent than Wallace. His book, The Malay Archipelago, influenced me, which in addition to being a great story, includes nifty maps and some lovely reproductions of woodcuts. As a most worthwhile bonus, his positive take on the lives and cultures of the indigenous people he encountered in the mid-19th century was way out of the mainstream. And for those interested in seances, well, never mind. There's something to be said for swaying in a hammock while marooned in the Spice Islands while running a high fever. An incredibly keen observer who was working in exactly the right place, Wallace was semi-delirious in that hammock when the concept of evolution by natural selection suddenly made sense from the patterns of distribution he had been observing throughout the archipelago involving beetles, birds of paradise, orangutans, and other organisms as he traveled between the islands. Both Wallace and Darwin arrived at their insights into the theory of natural selection independently. It was Wallace who contacted Darwin by letter, letting the genie out of the bottle. To the credit of both, they shared in the announcement of their discovery. But Darwin agonized literally for decades over whether or not he had enough data, what the presentation of his findings and the theory he had derived from it would mean for society, how his formidable and intimidating relatives, particularly his grandfather Erasmus, would regard him. And he probably worried about anything else he could think of, as well as including the possibility of getting scooped by Wallace. Would On the Origin of Species ever have been published had Wallace not written that letter? In case you wanted to jot down the books that Eric mentioned in this piece I just read, the first one was The Vegetation of Wisconsin by John T. Curtis. The second one was Those of the Forest by Wallace Grange, G-R-A-N-G-E. And the third was Alfred Russel Wallace's book, The Malay Archipelago, and that's spelled M-A-L-A-Y. And I don't want to forget that he also talked about Aldo Leopold's The Sand County Almanac. I'd like to read a little bit of Those of the Forest to follow up on Eric's suggestion. This is the beginning of chapter one. The snow world grays into dusk, then blackness. Color vanishes with the dim sun. Life, too, it seems, journeyed over the hills to sleep below the horizon for the night. There remains in the world the bleakness of more snow, sifting, 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 interminably downward. Steadily, rapidly, inexorably, tiny, hard, sharp, broken flakes jostling in their wind-tossed descent. The wind is here with the snow. It races across the miles, down from the sky, over the lake, through the hills, upon marsh and prairie and forest. It turns aside, seemingly for no barrier, asks leave of nothing, living or dead, stays its force for no obstacle. Tonight the wind and snow are the law. They are the elemental authority of all nature. This night other forces do their bidding. The wind and the snow exert all their power. They drive, ride, march, swirl, and possess the earth. Yet the wind and the snow are the serfs of cold. It is cold that squeezes the moisture of the sky into crystal white flakes. It is cold that signals the north wind on to lower and warmer latitudes. It's the cold that follows wind and snow, taking control of the great battered white world, freezing knife-carved drifts, hardening the crystal robe, which at first lies loosely upon the earth. The wind, the snow, and the cold give way only to the sun. To it, eventually, they give obedience, unwilling, perhaps, but disciplined. If their elemental forces are rebellious tonight, it matters not, for in good time the sun will control them. If not this day, then the next, or the day after. If not in January, then in May, but in the end always. Tonight the sun seems no longer to exist. It is gone behind the hills. It will not be back until earth turns again, until the forest meets dawn. Unimpeded, the wind, the snow, and the cold race on. Three icy elemental forces which howl, sting, and numb. It is no night for a timid rabbit. Even in the spreading shelter of the spruces, in the lee of the ridge along the swampy pocket, only one of the three elemental forces is to any perceptible degree frustrated. The wind, it is true, has spent some of its fury upon the supple cedars, upon the swaying figures of the spruces and the bare tamaracks. The wind intrudes less strongly into this little cavern beneath the lower branches of the swamp trees. But the chilly snow sifts down, much of it scarcely delayed a moment by the mad brushings of boughs. The cold is here, down to the very surface of the snow. Even below the snow it seeks the subterranean root and the vast soil, which snow, in a manner, protects. It is to this sheltered cavern beneath the evergreens, to a relative quiet, that the rabbit has come. Experience has brought him to this one sure sanctuary from storm. He is not alone. The deer is here, bedded down on the other side of the swamp. The deer and his herd, for this is their habitual winter home. The wolf is here, nose under tail, in a patch of willows at the cove, where interlaced branches and snow have all but built him a roof. The owl is here in the jungle of the densest trees, huddled close to the trunk of a black spruce, feathers fluffed to insulate its body from the fury. All those of the forest are here, those of the winter forest. The rabbit does not see or hear them all, each in its own niche, crevice, cavity, nest, den, or bed. He does not see the downy woodpecker and the chickadee, which the vicissitudes of the blizzard have brought roosting for the night in the same hollow aspen tree on the tiny swamp island, nor the red squirrel sleeping in a full bushel of moss, leaves, and soft bark, of which it has made a treetop nest in a cedar, nor the black bear living on its own fat in its den not far below a huge white pine stump, nor the woodchuck several feet down in the ground, unmindful in its hibernating torpor of the storm raging through the night above. The rabbit does not see among the logs, in the careless brush heaps of fallen trees, in the sedges and the grasses, in the buried litter of the forest floor, or in their snow tunnels, the deer mice, the meadow mice, the red-backed mice, and the shrews, or the weasel, which will later follow them. But seen or unseen, sleeping or awake, they are here, each in its own manner, protected from the wind, from the snow, from the cold, each pitted against the winter elements and surviving. Not all those of the forest have come, as has the rabbit to the swamp. In the channeled bole of a maple on the nearby ridge, a colony of carpenter ants are as motionless as death this winter night and will not awaken until spring. The beaver in its lodge in the pond near the swamp gnaws the green bark of an aspen twig away from the wind, the snow, and the cold, for these are shut out from its world tonight by the ice of the pond. A chrysalid on a dogwood rocks roughly in the wind, in a slow eddy downstream from a rock below the open riffles of the brook. A cluster of hibernating frogs wash gently to and fro in the water. Seeds and roots and buds are sleeping. Insects, larvae, and eggs lie dormant in wood, humus, and soil. Algae and bacteria, now wholly quiescent, nevertheless survive. By how many thousands of circumstances and stratagems the things of the forest turn aside, or circumvent, or tolerate the wind and the snow and the cold that own the world tonight. The first part of the program today was a part of Sumner Madison's book called A Field, and the second part was from Wallace Grange's book, Those of the Forest. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.